This summer, Louise Brown will turn 26. And the main reason that that's worth taking note has to do with the circumstances of her conception. Louise Brown was the world's first test tube baby. Her successful birth and normal development paved the way for a million other births like hers. Half of these have been here in the United States. This morning, in this part of Focus 580, we will look back to some of the history of the development of the technique of in vitro fertilization. And our guest for the program is Robin Marantz Hennig. She writes about science and medicine for many publications. She's written for The New York Times, for Scientific American, and Seed. She is the author of a number of books, including a new one that's titled Pandora's Baby. The subtitle is How the First Test Tube Babies Sparked the Reproductive Revolution. It's published by Houghton Mifflin. Now that in vitro fertilization has become something of a routine procedure, at least it's much more common, we tend to forget just how controversial it was back in the 1970s, as people raised concerns about the impact on society and also what it would mean for the children that were born by those means. She says that in her book that perhaps some of the most dire predictions did not pan out. However, it's still worth examining this history because it gives us some insight, perhaps, and some tools to use as we think about the newer reproductive technologies. As we talk this morning, questions and comments are certainly welcome. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line that is good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. Certainly questions from listeners are welcome. We just ask people to be brief, please, so that we can keep our program moving and get in as many people as possible. Ms. Hennig, hello.
Good morning, David.
Well, thank you for talking with us.
My pleasure.
We appreciate it. I think one of the things that you point out, and it's certainly very striking, is that when you take a look and you look back and you look at some of the things that people were saying about in vitro fertilization back in the 1970s, particularly those people who were very alarmed and were talking about possible negative, very negative consequences, it is very much the same things. People are saying very much the same sorts of things about genetic engineering and cloning, those
right.
things that are the controversial procedures today.
Right.
I know you're about to say it. It's even some of the same people.
Exactly. Right. It's some of the same people. It's some of the same words, and it's some of the same individuals, which is remarkable when you think about it.
So that obviously points to the fact that we're still conflicted, we're not quite sure how we feel about these things, and that there are indeed unresolved kind of questions about what exactly it means for humanity. Maybe not, and I don't know if that's putting it too boldly.
Well, it's putting it the way it's been put. You know, there are people who thought that if we were to allow in vitro fertilization, it would undermine the nuclear family and, you know, undo our sense of continuity and our relationship to ourselves and our children. And these are many of the same kind of grand fear scenarios that are being painted now about things like genetic engineering. It's much the same thing because you're sort of mucking about in the stuff of life. You know, this goes back to the ancients with fears about what Prometheus was doing when he stole fire from the gods. If you're able to manipulate certain essential parts of life, and if you're able to play around with the point at which life begins, these are issues that people have very, very strong feelings about.
Before people started to do experimentally to do in vitro fertilization, people were doing, were trying to assist humans to conceive by artificial insemination. How common a procedure was that before we really started to get going with in vitro, and was that controversial?
That was controversial. That is something that we now take almost more for granted than we take IVF, and we do take IVF for granted now. You know, I've heard it said that young women just figure it into their life plans, you know, grow up, go to college, have a career, get married, have IVF. You know, it's not something that people are ashamed of anymore. But for a long time, for about 50 years, artificial insemination was something that really worried people because, again, it was messing around with the beginnings of life and interfering with natural conception. And the controversial aspect of it in particular concerned using sperm from somebody who wasn't the husband. Mm-hmm. Usually that's what you needed to do, because the reason that you would need artificial insemination was that there was something wrong with the husband's sperm. So artificial insemination by donor became not common, but became something that people turned to. And there were actually laws on the books saying that the offspring that would result from that, even if the husband had consented to the procedure and understood that another man's sperm was going to be used, that the offspring was illegitimate. This was from the 1950s, and around that time is when people called babies born after artificial insemination, called them test tube babies. You know, that's what the phrase meant for a very long time. So that was kind of the early predecessor to some of the concerns that people then focused on IVF, and those same concerns that they're focusing now on other interventions.
Mm. Well, you can certainly see that if something like that was considered to be controversial, where conception was still taking place within the body of the mom,
mm-hmm.
the idea of having that take place by combining sperm and egg in a dish outside,
right.
and then letting that develop to a certain point and then taking that and putting it in the body of mom, I guess you can see how that certainly would be a leap, and people would be that much more exercised about that procedure because it's that much further from what is quote-unquote normal.
Right. But there's another way of looking at it, which is that the only thing that was different in IVF was where the conception took place, because because you did have to return the embryo back to the uterus, and you returned it pretty quickly. It was only a couple of cells large. You know, the concept, the term test tube baby had a lot of people thinking that the baby was grown outside of the uterus altogether and, you know, grown in a test tube. In fact, there were a lot of jokes about, you know, Louise Brown said that people would say to her, "Why aren't you long and thin?" You know, There was a certain amount of sick humor that was generated there. And you're right that it's a leap to go from accepting artificial insemination to accepting in vitro fertilization, but it's not as big a leap as you might think if you had a different way of looking at it, if you were just thinking that all that was changing really was the locus of the conception.
Yeah. Our guest this morning, Robin Morantz-Hennig. She's a journalist who writes about science. She is the author of a number of books, including one about the famous early geneticist Gregor Mendel. That book, titled The Monk in the Garden, it was a finalist for the National Book Critics Circle Award. Her most recent, that's the book we're talking about here this morning, is titled Pandora's Baby. It takes a look at some of the history of in vitro fertilization. It's published by Houghton Mifflin. Questions, welcome. 333-9455. Toll free, 800-222-9455. What you have done, I think, in the book is you've recovered some history that either people have forgotten or that maybe they didn't really know about. We've been talking here about Louise Brown, and she was born in 1978. But before that, in 1973, 5 years before that, there was an attempt to do this, to do in vitro fertilization. In fact, if that had gone ahead, Louise Brown would not have been the first baby. There would have been somebody else.
Right, and she would have been American.
And she would have been American. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And you tell the story about a couple, the Del Zitos, who were trying to have a baby and had been trying, using different kinds of methods, whatever was available, and they came across a doctor who was interested in trying this, and in fact did, and it started out, but the procedure wasn't completed.
It wasn't completed because, especially in 1973, when nothing approaching this had been done anywhere in the world, when the scientist's boss found out about it, he thought it was way too premature and dangerous and risky, and so he stopped the experiment. He pulled the petri dish where the cells were growing out of the incubator and ended up stopping the experiment. He put it in a freezer. And what ended up happening, you know, I not only recovered this story, but I had never heard it before. And I was surprised that I'd never heard it because I covered Louise Brown's birth as a reporter in 1978. So I was very focused on what the news was in reproductive technology. But somehow this was kind of obscure at the time, unless you were living in New York City where all of this took place. What ended up happening was this couple sued the administrator at the hospital for stopping the experiment. And the case came to trial, by coincidence, the same week that Louise Brown was born. So it kind of encapsulated everything about the way society's attitude changed in just those 5 years. Because 5 years earlier, in 1973, it was clearly, at least to a couple of scientists, a very premature procedure that was dangerous. And just 5 years later, in 1978, here was this perfectly normal baby born in England.
And what's really interesting, again, is that the man who was the boss of the doctor who had tried this in 1973, the man who, when he found out, said, no, we can't do this, I'm going to put a stop to it, his attitude certainly has changed.
Oh, yes, it did. And that was sort of my favorite part of the story. The boss's name was Raymond Bandewiel. And, you know, in 1973, he opened up the test tube and stopped the experiment. In 1978, he was on trial for doing so and actually lost to the Delvios. They had sued him for $1.5 million, and they got a lot less, but they won the case because the jury agreed that they had suffered. And then in 1983, 10 years after he had stopped this IVF experiment, he actually became the co-director of the first in vitro fertilization clinic in New York City. So in just those 10 years, in this one man, the procedure had turned from something that was abhorrent to something that was marketable. And a good, you know, a good way to practice your medicine.
Mm. Did the Delzio case, was that widely discussed and covered? And did that at the time start the debate going about whether or not it was appropriate, it was right, it was dangerous for this procedure to be used?
Well, there was a big media circus in New York while this was going on, and I think it's because, you know, the case was supposed to get started a couple of times before it ultimately did. And the few times that it had come before the judge and jury selection was supposed to begin, which was earlier in 1978, there was basically no attention paid to it at all. But then in July 1978, when jury selection was to begin, suddenly there were hordes of reporters out on the steps of the courthouse, because that was the week that there was news about, you know, the birth watch in England is what they called it. So it seemed to reporters in this country that it was a nice analogy, a nice American version of what was happening in England. And they were covering Louise Brown so avidly that they also then covered the Delvio case pretty avidly. Mm-hmm. And in the trial, a lot of those questions were raised. Is this something that we should do yet? Or was it something we should do yet 5 years earlier? It was hard to sort of recreate the mindset of 1973 in the middle of all this excitement over Louise Brown in 1978. But they tried to do that, and they tried to make it, to raise those questions. Is this something that scientists should be allowed to do? Was this the right scientist to have done it? A lot of it seemed to hinge on the reputation of the doctor who was involved in the experiment. And, you know, is this something that this couple was due? You know, I think that a lot of those questions get raised also. You know, should infertile couples be allowed to just sort of do whatever it takes to have their own biological children? And those are still questions that we're asking now about manipulating genes or testing for genetic disease or, you know, ultimately cloning.
Hmm. There's another part of this that I think is really interesting and worth talking about, and what it demonstrates is that there are unintended consequences of policy. People may think that one thing is the thing to do for a particular reason, and then it turns out that things end up going in a direction that they had not imagined. And what I'm getting at here is the notion that there were people back in the early 70s who thought that in vitro fertilization should not go ahead. And mm-hmm. the way to stop that was to say, well, there's going to be no government funding mm-hmm. of this kind of research. And that actually happened. And I think the point you make in the book is that the result was that those people being put out of business, they went and they found other funding, private funding. And indeed, it resulted in a kind of area of research that wasn't regulated. So it really had a very different kind of result, very different outcome than those people who said, well, let's stop this, and the way we'll stop this is by making sure that it doesn't get any federal money.
Right. You could understand how they could think that at first, that obviously federal money, the federal government is the biggest supporter of biomedical research. And so the presumption was, if we don't offer federal grants for this kind of research, then it won't get done. But then it went into the realm of entrepreneurial medical care delivery. And so the people who ended up paying for this research were actually the patients, the infertile couples themselves, who were charged exorbitant amounts of money. And it became something of a sort of rogue science. You know, the people who were doing IVF in many cases were not vetted by the government the way they would have been if they had had to apply for federal grants. They didn't really talk to each other except in an informal volunteer kind of way. Nobody was really asking them to collect data and submit findings and to do research at all. You know, this, it turned out not to be really a research enterprise. It was a clinical enterprise. So unfortunately, the lesson that I think is being learned from that, as people look now at some of the reproductive innovations that are possible, is instead of realizing that what they should have done all along was sort of guide it more carefully and provide some federal funding, which also comes along with it federal oversight, instead of that, they're saying, okay, not giving research grants wasn't enough to stop it, so we're going to just pass some laws to stop it. I don't think that's going to work really either. I think that what might result is some of what we've seen already, that the actual scientific developments will just get done in some other country. Mm. And that's never been good for the United States. You know, it always gets our competitive spirit going when we see, for example, that the first test tube baby in the world was born in England, not in the United States.
There's another piece here that you bring out in your reporting that I think hasn't been, at least I haven't seen, reported elsewhere. And it's connected with this last point that you were making. And that is that because this was done in the private sector and without the kind of oversight that you might at least expect if this was receiving government funding and government attention, there really wasn't very much attention paid to the issue of how healthy the babies are, and looking at this concern that some people did voice before it really got going about whether, in fact, the babies that would result would be healthy or whether they would be any more likely than babies who were conceived by the traditional means to have any kinds of problems. And apparently one of the things that you had found out is that in fact, these babies do have an elevated risk. I'm not sure how elevated, but they do, in fact, have a risk of certain problems that that babies made the old-fashioned way don't have.
Right. I think, well, early on, when people were concerned about what kind of hazards might be entailed in this procedure, they truly believed that monstrous changes would occur. You know, they even pretty forward-looking scientists couldn't quite imagine how it was possible to manipulate eggs and sperm in a petri dish and not do major chromosomal damage so that you would end up with some sort of a really bizarre genetic abnormality. So once Louise Brown and the other early test tube babies were obviously so normal, were basically normal, I think the relief was so gigantic that people didn't start looking for a while very carefully at what kind of other risks, more subtle risks, might be entailed. In addition, because of the way IVF is done, which is to fertilize a couple of eggs if you can and replace several of them into the uterus if you can, just in hopes that at least one of them will take into a pregnancy, there have always been significantly more cases in IVF babies of twins and triplets and sometimes even more compared to normally conceived children. And people have always known that multiples are at greater risk for certain birth defects or premature births or low birth weight. So that got confused early on, that if there were some higher rates of problems in IVF births, it seemed easy to attribute it for a while to the multiples. It's only relatively recently that somebody really sat down and said, let's take out the increased risk of a multiple birth and just see how risky IVF is itself, even if you're comparing singleton births. And there are, indeed, as you suggest, some higher rates of certain birth defects. They tend not to be severe, and they tend not to be common or significant, you know, hugely increased risks of problems, but there are, in fact, increased risks of problems.
I'm interested in having you talk a little bit more about the case of Louise Brown, and particularly I'm interested in what the reaction was in Britain, both on the level of people who make policy and just on the popular level, and whether this was whether there was an outcry, what kind of concern greeted it, was it particularly controversial?
There was an outcry, and it was controversial, but not to the same extent that it seemed to be here. And I think that the difference is that abortion politics didn't seem to drive the society as obviously in Great Britain as it did in this country. The anti-abortion forces were among the ones who were most vocally opposed to in vitro fertilization because it often meant that that some of the embryos who were created in petri dishes didn't get implanted and had to be discarded in one way or another. And abortion opponents thought that that was the same thing as an abortion, and they wanted to make sure that that wasn't allowed to happen. In England, there was a fair amount of concern about you know, treading on territory that was inappropriate for science to go. You know, the just sort of general religious sentiment that this was God's work and that people shouldn't be involved in it. But it wasn't quite to the same extent and the same intensity. And then what England ended up doing was they had a hard time also funding the work that was done by the doctors who created Louise Brown. They didn't really want to give them research grants either. But ultimately, they came up with a mechanism for overseeing this kind of research and providing funding for it, so that now there is a, you know, an advisory board that has to look at every kind of reproductive intervention that's proposed in terms of furthering research to figure out new ways to do these things, and they have to approve it. We don't have any such mechanism in this country.
It was just a couple of years later then here in the United States that someone opened up the first clinic to do IVF here in the United States. And this was, so this was only, have been a couple of years after Louise Brown and also then a couple of years after the trial involving the Delzios and the doctor the man who stepped in to that attempt back then. 5 years before to do IVF for them. So by the time that we get around to 79 and 80, when the first clinics open up to try to help people have babies in that way, was the atmosphere that much different then from between 19, how would it change between 1973 and say 1980?
Well, it was violently opposed to opening up the clinic. The first American IVF clinic was opened in Norfolk, Virginia, which is a pretty conservative part of the country. And it happened to be opening there almost as a fluke. You know, there were two very respected infertility scientists who had been at Johns Hopkins University in Baltimore for their entire careers, and then they were forced into retirement and brought down to Norfolk, where there was a new medical school that was trying to be innovative and trying to sort of make a name for itself, and the head of OBGYN there thought this was one way to do it. Let's get these two scientists, Howard and Georgiana Jones, who were highly respected, and get them working in infertility. The day Louise Brown was born was also the day that the Joneses were moving down to Norfolk, and they were interviewed by the local newspaper. And the reporter, kind of in an offhand way, said, well, can this test tube baby birth be done here? And Howard Jones, who's kind of a jokester, I guess, said, oh, sure, all we need is money. And suddenly money started coming in. So it wasn't even as though anybody had sort of picked out Norfolk on a map and said, this is where the first test tube baby clinic should be in this country. In fact, if anybody thought about it, they might have worked really hard not to have it be in Norfolk, because there were very active anti-abortion organizations there, and they were kind of really focused on doing anything that they could to keep that clinic from opening, to the point of demonstrations and petitions and state legislature hearings and national legislature hearings, trying to, you know, put out injunctions against opening the clinic, trying to accuse the doctors of being in collusion with the people who approved the clinic. I mean, it just went on and on for a very long time until, like, a year later, the clinic finally opened.
Mm-hmm.
And then it took another year for them to figure out how to do everything right and make their first patient successfully pregnant. It's not an easy thing to do, IVF. I mean, even now, the odds are against it that any one attempt will work. But in those days, it was even worse odds, you know, like one try in, I don't know, 5 to 10.
Hmm. But it was successful, and it was in 1981 that there in Norfolk, there the first America's first test tube baby was born.
Right, and she was born by that time. You know, I think it's easy for people to object to something in the abstract, but once they see the actual result, I think things get a little tempered down. You know, and she was also perfect and beautiful, and everybody was excited, and certainly the people who were so worried about how IVF would affect the nuclear family could see that this was a set of children who were desperately desired. You know, this was not something that was going to make people question what the parent-child bond was. It was going to make it more obvious what a really intense parent-child bond was. And so this little girl, Elizabeth Carr, was, you know, sort of America's sweetheart for a long time. And she was on the cover of Life magazine, and Louise Brown was on the cover of Life magazine. I mean, it was a little love fest of these adorable little babies. And in many ways, that sort of made the whole thing seem less scary.
Mm-hmm. The fact that people seem to be sympathetic with the idea of people wanting to have children that badly. And also, I suppose it did, as we were talking earlier, did help the fact that we were talking about here children that were the biological child of both the parents. Mm-hmm. We're not talking about anybody else's DNA. It's theirs. It's just that it required a little bit of engineering to help the natural process along.
Right. But, of course, the next steps were kind of inevitable, that once you did that with a mother and father who were married and who were using their own sex cells, you could also do it with donated eggs or donated sperm, and you could, you know, implant the mother and father's embryo into a surrogate mother. And, you know, there were all these other twists on straight reproduction that could be introduced because you had the technology. And some of that was what people were so worried about. You know, there was a lot of concern about what they were calling the slippery slope, you know, that if you take one step, even if the first step isn't all that objectionable, it gets you to the next step, which might be objectionable.
Yeah, and ultimately to what nowadays people would say was the most objectionable point of all, and that would be reproductive cloning.
That's right. And the fact is, you know, I kind of hate to say this because I'm opposed personally to the slippery slope argument because I think it's very regressive, but the fact is, you couldn't do reproductive cloning if you hadn't first done IVF and figured out how to perfect all those other steps, because the beginning of reproductive cloning looks just the same as IVF, the only difference being that you're not really mixing an egg and a sperm. You're doing something to an egg to make it think it's been fertilized, but the growth in the petri dish is the same, and the placing that growing embryo back into a uterus is the same.
We're a little bit past our midpoint here. I should introduce again our guest. We're speaking with Robin Marantz Hennig. She's author of 8 books. Her previous, The Monk in the Garden, The Lost and Found Genius of Gregor Mendel, was a finalist for the National Book Critics Circle Award. She writes about science and medicine for publications including The New York Times, Scientific American, and Seed. And she's the author of the book that we're talking about here this morning. It's titled Pandora's Baby, How the First Test Tube Babies Sparked the Reproductive Revolution. And it is published by Houghton Mifflin. And questions are certainly welcome here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line that's good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. I mentioned back at the beginning of the program that in the time since Louise Brown was born, we've had something like a million other babies that were conceived and born as a result of IVF. You also talked about the fact that it's still, while it's a procedure that we understand better how to do now, that it's still, it's not foolproof, and the rate of success is not 100%.
Right. But, you know, the rate of success in any attempt at conception is not 100%. The difference is, well, the big difference, I think, is that it's no fun to try and fail the way it might be when you're trying to conceive the old-fashioned way. And nobody's really counting the denominator in quite the same way when you're just trying to conceive a child. This, you're very focused on the fact that because there's a lot of discomfort, sometimes pain, and expense involved in every attempt, so you're very focused on how many attempts you have to go through before you have a success. But in normal sexual intercourse, the odds of actually, you know, unprotected, the odds of actually conceiving a child are about the same as what we've gotten to with IVF, about one chance in, what is it, it's something like 20% chance of actually leading to an actual birth.
That's, you know, that's an interesting point, and I think it's something worth thinking about, and if people don't, is that even as you say, is with the old-fashioned way, there are sometimes, when you think about everything that has to happen for a successful conception, and then for that to implant, and then for the whole thing to get going, you have to sit back and think, you know, it's remarkable that it happens at all.
That's right. I mean, nature has this way of just, working out, but a lot of fertilizations just don't implant, often because there's some sort of a genetic problem that keeps that embryo from really being viable, or a whole series of other things regarding timing or, people don't quite know yet. I mean, that's a big field of research is why it is that not every attempt at conception actually leads to a pregnancy.
One of the things that I'm sure that once we got into doing IVF and people began to understand that it was possible to take the sperm and the egg, to get them together in a dish, and to have that develop to a certain point and have that then take that and implant it in the mom, got it more reasonable to start thinking about, well, not only could you just simply take the two and put them together and make that happen, but that at least opens the door to the idea of genetic manipulation, and, mm-hmm. which gets us into the whole idea of designer babies that in some people's minds would say, well, that's maybe something that's interesting to talk about, but the technology, our ability to do that, is so far away that it's almost not worth thinking about. Now that we've at least got the human genome mapped, we still really don't know how it works, but we sort of have a roadmap. Then now that starts to feel just a little bit more within reach,
right?
And gets you again thinking about those ideas that people have outlined, that at some point in the future, people could go into a clinic and sit down with a kind of a checklist and say, well, okay, what kind of baby do you want? And you could check off, well, say, I think I'd like to have blonde, I'd like to have blue eyes, I'd like her to be tall and beautiful so she could be a model, but I'd also like her to be able to get a volleyball scholarship to college, and mm-hmm. I'd like her to be a concert violinist.
But, you know, we're already doing that. If you look at websites for sperm banks, mm-hmm. there are already those checklists for what kind of a sperm donor you're looking for, not only the way he looks and what his athletic abilities might be, but what his personality characteristics are like. I think that there is a belief in this culture that a whole lot of things are there in our genes, and if we can just find the right ones, and this isn't involving manipulation, this is just involving choosing them at this point, choosing the ones that are already out there. But if you think about it, you know, sort of looking for what hobbies this guy has, who's, you know, and whether you're going to take sperm from a guy who's, you know, a good guitarist versus a good pianist. I mean, that's, a little bit extreme to me. But one of the things that is necessary for allowing genetic enhancement to take place, we're already pretty good at doing, which is what's called pre-implantation genetic diagnosis. I mean, you can take a four-celled embryo that's been created with IVF, so you can take it in its petri dish, and actually take one of those four cells, which is a big chunk of the embryo, and analyze its genes under a microscope and see whether it's chromosomally normal. People are doing that now to screen for embryos that might have a particular genetic disease, but it's the same exact procedure that you would use to screen for an embryo that has the eye color you're looking for.
Hmm. Certainly there has been a lot of coverage in the media of the Human Genome Project and of our getting to a better understanding about DNA, about what the pieces are, what we think that they do, and certainly among researchers, there's been a lot of interest in trying to identify individual genes and say, okay, this one right here does this, and this does that, and to take it beyond the fact that there are some genes that seem to be linked to disease, take it to what some people would argue to be sort of unreasonable places where you start talking about genes for criminal behavior or genes for risk-taking or, you know, what have you. And certainly there's been a lot of coverage of that, and they're interesting questions and interesting stories, but I guess I wonder whether you think that something about the coverage has led to, in a lot of people's minds, to that kind of genetic determinism that says when you look at this balance of genes and environment and experience and what makes people, what makes us who we are, that the pendulum has swung too much over to the gene side, and that has to do with the way that these stories have been written.
Well, when you've got articles that announce the gene for anything, the gene for homosexuality, the gene for shyness, it's inevitable that people will think that means that there's such a thing as one particular gene leading to one particular kind of behavior. Or even one particular disease, the gene for breast cancer. But even the things that seem pretty straightforward, pretty much related to one gene, even those don't always express themselves in a clearly predictable way. You know, one of the things that the Human Genome Project showed us, and I don't know if this has been conveyed adequately in the press, is that there are many fewer genes in the human genome than we originally thought.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when they went into it, they thought that they had to sequence 100,000 genes, and then ultimately they found that there are more like 30,000. That means that each of those genes has to do basically three times as much work as originally conceived. And the only way that it could do that is that there are other conditions that must be set also that turn certain genes on and off or that make them behave in one way in the presence of another gene versus a different way in the presence of a different gene. And there's a lot more about genetic interactions that must be going on in order for only 30,000 genes to accomplish all of the variety that we see in the human species. So what the Human Genome Project did was, yes, it laid out, sort of the order in which the DNA base pairs are arrayed on the human genome, but it didn't really help us understand yet how each of those genes expresses itself. And until we do understand that, the concept that we can somehow pull out a bad gene and put in a good one, that we're not going to be able to do that. We might eventually, but that's still way down the road.
Our guest in this part of Focus 580, Robin Marantz-Hennig. She's a journalist who writes about science and medicine. Her most recent book, the one here we're talking about this morning, is titled Pandora's Baby, How the First Test Tube Baby Sparked the Reproductive Revolution. And it's published by Houghton Mifflin. We have about 15 minutes left, and we have a caller here. We'll get right to on line number one in Urbana. Hello.
Yeah, I just have two questions. One is, does your guest know anything about this Dr. Norbert Gleischer, I believe his name is, who I read an article last year in the Daily Telegraph that mentioned that he had created chimeras, human chimeras. Do you know anything about him?
I don't know about him in particular, but I have heard reports of human chimeras, which is sort of a bizarre twist on what can be done. What some scientists are doing, and they're doing it for research purposes, and they're not like trying to create animal humans that will be born. Is they're mixing sometimes some cells from one species with some cells from another species, sometimes involving humans, and growing up embryos that seem to be relatively normal. There have been a lot of instances of cross-species fertilization. You know, some scientists actually use cow eggs and insert human DNA into that in an attempt to see whether nuclear transfer, which is the first step in cloning, can be accomplished. Not to create a cow that has human genes, but just to do it as an experimental manipulation. And so maybe Dr. Gleischer did it for that same reason. I'm not familiar with his work in particular.
Yeah, the article says that what he was creating were hermaphrodites.
Hermaphrodites. Yeah, the she-males. I've seen some reports about that too. That they take some female cells and some male cells. This is different from taking egg and sperm, which are supposed to mix in nature, but they're taking some female body cells and some male body cells and merging them together so that you get an embryo that has a little of both.
Yeah, well, I really don't recall the details, but mm-hmm. My big question was something you kind of touched earlier, and that is, but you didn't actually get into it. You just kind of said that's a big area of research, but I was just curious if you get into it a little bit more, and that is, you know, it seems that a layman's point of view would be that the sperm, so the selection of which sperm will fertilize the egg, has kind of a contest of characteristic to it, mm-hmm. and in fact, there's even a way to select gender based on, sort of based on the acidity of the birth canal and all that stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And I was just wondering, how are scientists approaching this whole question of whether this is a process that if skipped over is going to hurt us? Because there can't be a heck of a lot of data to work with out mm-hmm. there.
Well, you're right, and that is one of the things that's concerned scientists a great deal. They've always known that. For example, the way conception occurs in the body is that the sperm travel up the fallopian tube in the woman's body and find the egg somewhere along the way up there, and encircle it and try to fertilize it. They've always known that the sperm that make their way up to the top of the fallopian tube most quickly are the hardiest sperm. You know, it's kind of a little survival of the fittest competition right there. Before fertilization even occurs. So there has been a concern that if what you're doing is taking relatively weak swimmers and putting them in a petri dish and giving them this unfair advantage, that you might in fact allow the less hardy sperm to succeed in a way that they wouldn't in nature. This hasn't been a big, big problem until a more recent development in IVF that's called ICSI. It stands for intracytoplasmic sperm injection. And basically, you're taking sperm that are too weak even to get inside of an egg in the petri dish, you know, even when they're delivered right there to the egg. And so you take a very, very fine needle and put a single sperm into it and inject it into the egg and allow it to fertilize the egg in that way. Now, the babies who were born after ICSI do seem to have a higher rate of birth defects than babies born after just straight IVF, because ICSI sort of takes that concern one step further and not only takes some possibly weak sperm and allows them to compete with other sperm that might not be all that strong either, but takes a really weak sperm and does all the work for it. So you're right to raise that question about whether we're in the laboratory sort of going over the step that, that happens in nature that allows for the hardiest to win in the competition.
And it sounds as if they don't really know for a fact, but it's not a problem because it's not widespread enough, I suppose.
Well, ICSI isn't used a whole lot, but it is a field of research that people are starting to look at. You know, they are starting to get concerned about, especially some of these variations on IVF that might actually exacerbate the unfairness of the situation.
Yeah. So if you were going to write some science fiction, say, you would like to include an answer to the question or some approach that would still select the sperm based on hardiness or something like that.
Right. I don't know how that would happen, because if they were hardy, then you wouldn't come to a fertility clinic to begin with.
Yeah. Okay, thanks.
All right, thank you. Uh-huh. Other questions are welcome. 333-9455. Toll free, 800-222-9455. I just want to go back to, you know, we were talking earlier about the fact that early on, when IVF was just beginning to get going, and there were people who were concerned about it on either ethical, moral grounds or otherwise, who said, we don't think this should go ahead. Their way of trying to stop it was to say, no federal funding for the research.
Mm-hmm.
And what happened was that private research money came along and funded it, and the work went ahead. And there were certain consequences that we've discussed. Can you take that and apply it to the way that people now are thinking about cloning? Because they seem to be taking the same kind of approach. They'd say, we don't think this should happen, so we're going to say that there should be no federal money for this, but that still opens up the possibility that there will be private money, and again, that the research and its applications, because it's privately funded, will essentially go unregulated.
Well, that's one way that it could happen, and the other way that it could happen is something that a lot of people are trying for, which is to outlaw cloning altogether, you know, to pass a law in Congress that says reproductive cloning cannot occur. And there's even attempts to pass a law that says not only reproductive cloning, but the research kind of cloning that's known as therapeutic cloning can't occur either. You know, therapeutic cloning is what you need to do if you're going to create a source of embryonic stem cells for an individual. And there's some fear that if you allow therapeutic cloning to happen in a laboratory, it'll be no big deal to take some of those cloned embryos and implant some of them into somebody's uterus and grow up an actual human clone. So I think people are taking a little less of a laissez-faire attitude now than they did 30 years ago with IVF. I think that they're seeing that there is still this entrepreneurial possibility. You know, there's still market forces that are going to maybe ask for this to happen, and so they're thinking of just banning it outright. The other side of it, though, is that I don't personally think that cloning is going to be something that's in huge demand the way IVF turned out to be. I think it's too difficult and too strange. I think that that people are only going to turn to cloning in very rare instances where there's really no other way to figure out how to create one's own biological child.
So you don't see that as being just another another tool in the toolkit of helping infertile couples?
Well, I think that it'll be a tool, but it'll do different things. I mean, there's a way to use cloning technology to actually create eggs, you know, sort of the genetic equivalent of an egg for a woman who doesn't make her own eggs,
mm-hmm.
so that you can begin by cloning her. But then you can reduce the number of genes in the cell to only half of the full human complement, which is what's in eggs and sperm, and then allow it to mix with the genes from a sperm and do what's ordinarily done, you know, this random mixing up of mother and father, so that what you would end up with is not a clone of this woman, but you would have used cloning technology to allow her to make her own genetic eggs. That's also something that's a long way off, but I think that if people are given that option, they would probably tend to prefer creating a child who's a little bit more like what you'd expect one's child to be, which is a mixture of you and somebody else.
And if that would, I guess I'm thinking about the, you know, the fact that when it came to in vitro fertilization, that people started feeling better about it when they actually saw the result, whether in fact if that we got to the point that would happen, that then people would maybe feel a little bit more comfortable with the idea of reproductive cloning, again for the same reason, because they'd see the result. Here it was. Here is this baby, and it looks like these two people, and genetically it's the product of those two people, and, you know, so what's the big deal?
Right. I also think, though, that if there were actual, literal clones who were born, people might feel better about that, too, because you're not going to get a baby who's the exact replica of its clone donor. You know, a lot of other things are going to have been different, beginning with the egg in which that clone was grown up and the uterus in which that clone was grown up. And as I said before, with knowing how few genes there are in the human genome, we now suspect that there are a lot of environmental influences that are going to affect the way the genes actually behave. And those environmental influences include things like, you know, in utero conditions.
Well, we'll have to leave it at that because we've come to the end of the time. For people who are interested in reading the story, I want to again mention the book we have talked about. It's titled Pandora's Baby, the subtitle How the First Test Tube Babies Sparked the Reproductive Revolution, published by Houghton Mifflin, by our guest, Robin Marantz-Hennig. She's the author of 8 others. If you're interested in reading some of the history of genetics, you might look at her previous book, The Monk in the Garden. It was a finalist for the National Book Critics Circle Award. And Ms. Hennig, thanks very much for talking with us today.
Thank you for having me.